Chapter 18. A mood of blitheness rarely experienced even by young men was Dick's on the following Monday morning. It was the week after the Easter holidays, and he was journeying along with Smart the mare and the light spring cart, watching the damp slopes of the hillsides as they streamed in the warmth of the sun, which at this unsettled season shone on the grass with the freshness of an occasional inspector, rather than as an accustomed proprietor. His errand was to fetch Fancy, and some additional household goods, from her father's house in the neighboring parish to her dwelling at Mellstock. The distant view was darkly shaded with clouds, but the nearer parts of the landscape were whitely illumined by the visible rays of the sun streaming down across the heavy gray shade behind. The tranter had not yet told his son of the state of Shiner's heart that had been suggested to him by Shiner's movements. He preferred to let such delicate affairs right themselves, experience having taught him that the uncertain phenomenon of love, as it existed in other people, was not a groundwork upon which a single action of his own life could be founded. Geoffrey Day lived in the depths of Yalberry Wood, which formed portion of one of the outlying estates of the Earl of Wessex, to whom Day was head gamekeeper, timber steward, and general overlooker for this district. The wood was intersected by the highway from Casterbridge to London at a place not far from the house, and some trees had of late years been felled between its windows and the ascent of Yalberry Hill, to give the solitary cottager a glimpse of the passers-by. It was a satisfaction to walk into the keeper's house, even as a stranger, on a fine spring morning like the present. A curl of wood smoke came from the chimney, and drooped over the roof like a blue feather in a lady's hat, and the sun shone obliquely upon the patch of grass in front, which reflected its brightness through the open doorway, and up the staircase opposite, lighting up each riser with a shiny green radiance, and leaving the top of each step in shade. The windowsill of the front room was between 4 and 5 feet from the floor, dropping inwardly to a broad low bench, over which, as well as over the whole surface of the wall beneath, there always hung a deep shade, which was considered objectionable on every ground save one, namely, that the perpetual sprinkling of seeds and water by the caged canary above was not noticed as an eyesore by visitors. The window was set with thickly leaded diamond glazing, formed, especially in the lower panes, of knotty glass of various shades of green. Nothing was better known to Fancy than the extravagant manner in which these circular knots or eyes distorted everything seen through them from the outside, lifting hats from heads, shoulders from bodies, scattering the spokes of cart wheels, and bending the straight fir trunks into semicircles. The ceiling was carried by a beam traversing its midst, from the side of which projected a large nail, used solely and constantly as a peg for Geoffrey's hat. The nail was arched by a rainbow-shaped stain, imprinted by the brim of the said hat, when it was hung there dripping wet. The most striking point about the room was the furniture. This was a repetition upon inanimate objects of the old principle introduced by Noah, consisting for the most part of two articles of every sort. The duplicate system of furnishing owed its existence to the forethought of Fancy's mother, exercised from the date of Fancy's birthday onwards. The arrangement spoke for itself. Nobody who knew the tone of the household could look at the goods without being aware that the second set was a provision for Fancy when she should marry and have a house of her own. The most noticeable instance was a pair of green-faced eight-day clocks, ticking alternately, which were severally 2.5 minutes and 3 minutes striking the hour of 12, one proclaiming, in Italian flourishes, Thomas Wood as the name of its maker, and the other arched at the top, and altogether of more cynical appearance, that of Ezekiel Saunders. They were two departed clockmakers of Casterbridge, whose desperate rivalry throughout their lives was nowhere more emphatically perpetuated than here at Geoffrey's. These chief specimens of the marriage provision were supported on the right by a couple of kitchen dressers, each fitted complete with their cups, dishes, and plates, in their turn followed by two dumb waiters, two family Bibles, two warming pans, and two intermixed sets of chairs. But the position last reached the chimney corner was, after all, the most attractive side of the parallelogram. It was large enough to admit, in addition to Jeffrey himself, Jeffrey's wife, her chair, and her work table, entirely within the line of the mantle, without danger or even inconvenience from the heat of the fire, and was spacious enough overhead to allow of the insertion of wood poles for the hanging of bacon, which were cloaked with long shreds of soot, floating on the draft like the tattered banners on the walls of ancient aisles. These points were common to most chimney corners of the neighborhood. But one feature there was which made Jeffrey's fireside, not only an object of interest to casual aristocratic visitors to whom every cottage fireside was more or less a curiosity, but the admiration of friends who were accustomed to fireplaces of the ordinary hamlet model. This peculiarity was a little window in the chimney back, almost over the fire, around which the smoke crept caressingly when it left the perpendicular course. The window board was curiously stamped with black circles, burnt thereon by the heated bottoms of drinking cups, which had rested there after previously standing on the hot ashes of the hearth for the purpose of warming their contents, the result giving to the ledge the look of an envelope which has passed through innumerable post offices. Fancy was gliding about the room preparing dinner, her head inclining now to the right, now to the left, and singing the tips and ends of tunes that sprang up in her mind like mushrooms. The footsteps of Mrs. Day could be heard in the room overhead. Fancy went finally to the door. "Father! Dinner!" A tall spare figure was seen advancing by the window with periodical steps, and the keeper entered from the garden. He appeared to be a man who was always looking down, as if trying to recollect something he said yesterday. The surface of his face was fissured rather than wrinkled, and over and under his eyes were folds which seemed as a kind of exterior eyelids. His nose had been thrown backwards by a blow in a poaching fray, so that when the sun was low and shining in his face, people could see far into his head. There was in him a quiet grimness, which would in his moments of displeasure have become surliness, had it not been tempered by honesty of soul, and which was often wrong-headedness, because not allied with subtlety. Although not an extraordinarily taciturn man among friends slightly richer than himself, he never wasted words upon outsiders, and to his trapper Enoch his ideas were seldom conveyed by any other means than nods and shakes of the head. Their long acquaintance with each other's ways, and the nature of their labors, rendered words between them almost superfluous as vehicles of thought, whilst the coincidence of their horizons, and the astonishing equality of their social views, by startling the keeper from time to time as very damaging to the theory of master and man, strictly forbade any indulgence in words as courtesies. Behind the keeper came Enoch, who had been assisting in the garden, at the well-considered chronological distance of 3 minutes, an interval of non-appearance on the trapper's part not arrived at without some reflection. 4 minutes had been found to express indifference to indoor arrangements, and simultaneousness had implied too great an anxiety about meals. A little earlier than usual, Fancy, the keeper said, as he sat down and looked at the clocks. Had Ezekiel Saunders, oh thine is tearing on the four Thomas Wood again. I kept in the middle between them, said Fancy, also looking at the two clocks. Better stick to Thomas, said her father. Here's a healthy beaten Thomas, that would lead a man to swear by an offhand. He is as true as the town time. How is it your stepmother isn't here? As Fancy was about to reply, the rattle of wheels was heard, and way, smart. And Mr. Richard Dewey's voice rolled into the cottage from round the corner of the house. Hello. There's Dewey's cart come for thee, Fancy Dick driving aforetime to. Well, ask the lad to have potluck with us. Dick, on entering, made a point of implying by his general bearing that he took an interest in Fancy simply as in one of the same race and country as himself, and they all sat down. It could have wished her manner had not been so entirely free from all apparent consciousness of those accidental meetings of theirs. But he let the thought pass. Enoch sat diagonally at a table afar off, under the corner cupboard, and drank his cider from a long perpendicular pint cup. Having tall fir trees done in brown on its sides, he threw occasional remarks into the general tide of conversation, and with this advantage to himself, that he participated in the pleasures of a talk, slight as it was, at meal times, without saddling himself with the responsibility of sustaining it. "Why don't your stepmother come down, Fancy?" said Jeffrey. "You'll excuse her, Mr. Dick, she's a little queer sometimes." "Oh yes, quite," said Richard, as if he were in the habit of excusing people every day. "She'd belong to that class of womankind that become second wives. A rum class, rather." "Indeed," said Dick, with sympathy for an indefinite something. "Yes, and 'tis trying to a female, especially if you've been a first wife, as she a. Very trying it must be." "Yes. You see her first husband, and was a young man, who let her go too far. In fact, she used to kick up Bob's a dying at the least thing in the world. And when I'd married her, and found it out, I thought, thinks I, 'tis too late now, to begin to cure ye, and so I let her bide. But she's queer, very queer, at times." "I'm sorry to hear that." "Yes. There, wives be such a provoking class o' society, because though they be never right, they be never more than half wrong." Fancy seemed uneasy under the infliction of this household moralizing, which might tend to damage the airy-fairy nature that Dick, as maiden shrewdness told her, had accredited her with. Her dead silence impressed Jeffrey with the notion that something in his words did not agree with her educated ideas, and he changed the conversation. "Did Fred Shiner send the casco drink, Fancy?"
"I think he did."
"Oh yes, he did. Nice solid feller, Fred Shiner," said Jeffrey to Dick as he helped himself to gravy, bringing the spoon round to his plate by way of the potato dish, to obviate a stain on the cloth in the event of a spill. Now Jeffrey's eyes had been fixed upon his plate for the previous 4 or 5 minutes, and in removing them, he had only carried them to the spoon, which, from its fullness and the distance of its transit, necessitated a steady watching through the whole of the route. Just as intently as the keeper's eyes had been fixed on the spoon, Fancy's had been fixed on her father's, without premeditation or the slightest phase of furtiveness. But there they were fastened. This was the reason why. Dick was sitting next to her on the right side, and on the side of the table opposite to her father. Fancy had laid her right hand lightly down upon the tablecloth for an instant, and to her alarm Dick, after dropping his fork and brushing his forehead as a reason, flung down his own left hand, overlapping a third of Fancy's with it, and keeping it there. So the innocent Fancy, instead of pulling her hand from the trap, settled her eyes on her father's, to guard against his discovery of this perilous game of Dick's. Dick finished his mouthful. Fancy finished her crumb, and nothing was done beyond watching Jeffrey's eyes. Then the hand slid apart. Fancy's going over 6 inches of cloth, Dick's over 1. Jeffrey's eye had risen. "I said Fred Shiner is a nice solid feller," he repeated, more emphatically.
"He is, yes, he is," stammered Dick, "but to me, he is little more than a stranger."
"Oh, sure. Now I know N as well as any man can be known. And you know N very well too, don't ye, Fancy?" Jeffrey put on a tone expressing that these words signified at present about 100 times the amount of meaning they conveyed literally. Dick looked anxious. "Will you pass me some bread?" said Fancy in a flurry, the red of her face becoming slightly disordered, and looking as solicitous as a human being could look about a piece of bread.
"Eh, that I will," replied the unconscious Jeffrey.
"Why," he continued, returning to the displaced idea, "we are likely to remain friendly, why, Mr. Shiner, if the wheels run smooth.
An excellent thing, a very capital thing, as I should say, the youth answered with exceeding relevance, considering that his thoughts, instead of following Jeffrey's remark, were nestling at a distance of about 2 feet on his left the whole time. A young woman's face will turn the north wind, Master Richard. My heart if twant. Dick looked more anxious, and was attentive in earnest at these words. S. Turn the north wind, added Jeffrey after an impressive pause. Indeed, oh, she's one of my own flesh and blood. Dot, will you fetch down a bit of raw mill cheese from pantry shelf? Fancy interrupted, as if she were famishing. Eh, that I will, cheel, cheel, says I, and Mr. Shiner only asking last Saturday night. Dot dot cheese, you said, fancy? Dick controlled his emotion at these mysterious allusions to Mr. Shiner, the better enabled to do so by perceiving that Fancy's heart went not with her father's, and spoke like a stranger to the affairs of the neighborhood. S. There's a great deal to be said upon the power of maiden faces in settling your courses, he ventured, as the keeper retreated for the cheese. The conversation is taking a very strange turn. Nothing that I have ever done warrants such things being said, murmured Fancy with emphasis, just loud enough to reach Dick's ears. You think to yourself, 'twas to be, cried Enoch from his distant corner, by way of filling up the vacancy caused by Jeffrey's momentary absence. And so you marry her, Master Dewey, and there's an end of it. Pray don't say such things, Enoch, came from Fancy severely, upon which Enoch relapsed into servitude. If we be doomed to marry, we marry, if we be doomed to remain. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.